You're listening to the On-Call Nightmares podcast, and I bring you conversations with technologists who've spent time on call. So, I wanted to bring you a little something that was different from usual. I normally do the podcast, and I've got the rules and a format that people are used to, but this time I wanted to kind of switch it up. And so what I did was I went to someone that I think is hysterical, interesting, and just a really good person, and that's Corey Quinn. He's the cloud economist from the Duckbill Group. You may have heard of his newsletter this last week in AWS. He's just a really interesting person that's always helping people get the most out of their cloud bills, and I appreciate it. So what else has been going on? I'm just kind of wrapping up the year, to be honest with you. 2019 was a lot of fun. I got to meet a lot of people. I got to talk to tons of people with this podcast, did some traveling, and I really enjoyed what I got to be part of. So that was a full year of podcasting that I got done, and let me tell you, it was just great. Thank you for all of you for listening and being a part of making sure I've been able to spread information about these people's stories. And if you want your story recorded and brought onto the podcast, it's real easy. Just send me an email. It's oncallnightmares@gmail.com. Reach out to me on Twitter @oncallnightmare. So let's get into this week's conversation. It is with none other than Corey Quinn. You can find him on Twitter @QuinnyPig. And I think you're going to enjoy this. So let's get right into it. You're listening to the On-Call Nightmares podcast, and I bring you conversation with technologists who've spent time on call. And, you know, we're heading toward the very few last days of 2019, and I wanted to use this as an opportunity to speak to a friend and a person that really has what I believe a great grasp on what's going on across technology in the world of cloud, ops, you name it. He kind of has an idea of what's going on for us all. Corey Quinn is a cloud economist at the Duckbill Group and a really just funny and great guy. And Corey, from what I know of you, you had some really good leisure time just recently. So I hope you're well rested.
Oh, yes. Prepping for a reInvent is always the best way to take a little time off and do a vacation. Thanks for having me, Jay. I appreciate it.
No problem. It's really good to talk to you. I know we're getting really close to Christmas, and we all want to do our things and finish up the year. So I wanted to finish up the year talking to you about kind of what's going on in around what I would call the cloud world, technology, some things that you're excited. But before we get into that, there's one thing that I kind of know about you, and I think you've mentioned it to me before. But you started Duckbill Group, which is helping people save money on their AWS bills out of being on call. You want to tell me a little about it?
Sure. I started off my career in an on-call scenario that was, well, I'd call it abusive, but I don't think that really goes far enough. Mm-hmm. I was at a company for 2 years, and 1 year in, we had a new manager who was dropped in, and the first thing that he did was decided he was not going to be on call himself because he was always the point of escalation. So he was, quote, always on call. At the same time, someone in our group was transferring out. So, surprise, we went from having 4 people in an on-call rotation, which is still a little eh, to 2. It was a 50% on-call rotation, which is about as horrible as it sounds. At that point, you can't really schedule your life around it anymore. So your SLA becomes best effort. But mm-hmm. I was too early in my career to understand and appreciate that. So instead, it wound up being this hellacious year. And at the end of that, I swore I'd never be put myself in that situation again. And I've done on-call jobs since then, but I've always been extremely sensitive about being protective of my time and protective of other people's time on it. So when I started the first version of what became the Duckbill Group 3 years mm-hmm. ago, one of the things that was important to me was that we made sure that anything that I did was absolutely going to revolve around a problem that was business hours only, because mm-hmm. I wasn't going to be woken up at 3 o'clock in the morning. Incidentally, you take a look at what's on call and what people are getting woken up for. Good heavens, wake up, Taylor. We're not able to show ads to people on the internet when they're trying to do other things. I understand the business need behind that, but that is the worst of all possible worlds, because you're waking up for something that frankly, for a lot of people, when your service isn't working, the internet is better. That just never seemed to be worth it. I mean, we're not out here, most of us anyway, generating or supporting things that are life critical. So yeah, if you're a doctor and you're on call and you get woken up and go to the emergency room, terrific. There's actually something really important and uplifting and noble about that. Showing ads to people on the internet is the exact opposite of everything that makes you feel good about that story.
Yeah, I get it. And on the other side of that, you know, last week I spoke with Kelsey Hightower. One of the things that he really put into perspective is like he was supporting financial transactions for things like EBT cards. And I was like, well, there's a noble pursuit of insuring and all the time SLA. And one of the reasons why I appreciated the story, because he talked about how his on-call was actually directly related to whether or not people could buy food.
Right. That's something that's seriously important.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting how we've made a lot of advancements in the on-call process, but the reasoning behind it, I think, is something that a lot of us are still trying to figure out.
Absolutely. And I don't see a whole lot of variance based upon the on-call expectations and responsibilities, regardless of when there's that extreme variance between what the company actually does. Mm-hmm. Your Twitter for pets, you also need that same 5.9s Target, but 3.9s SLA. No, you don't. Really don't.
It's funny because that's, I've heard you say that a few times, and it's really resonated with me of what, as I've talked to people like in the last year or so about this redundancy fetish that's kind of happened across the world in tech, and the fact that people see that they have all these available products to them and think they need them all. And that extra 9 that they get out of it really doesn't make a big difference.
Exactly. It's sort of similar in some ways, not to put words in others' mouths, but you look at Netflix and the extreme value that they placed on chaos engineering for a long time. Mm-hmm. At this point, Netflix doesn't have a reputation for dropping down and falling off the internet. So at some point, it's how much business benefit is there to additional layers of reliability on top of what they currently have? I mean, mm-hmm. I can't speak for them. I don't know what the answer to that question is, but I have to imagine it is not the make or break business critical issue that potentially it may have been back when they started down the path of implementing chaos engineering.
Sure. And the fact is that they have built more reliable services based on those early implementations of chaos that they did. Maybe they have it set that their chaos engine of whatever it is at this point now really is a set and forget part of the monitoring process now. Who knows? Regardless, it's been interesting to see how much people have put into, I got to get all the 9s in the world, when they keep hearing from other companies, you don't need all those 9s, relax.
Context is everything, and I think that people tend to lose sight of that. What works for another company works and aligns with their business needs that very well may not align with anything you've got going on.
So one of the things that I really want to talk about, specifically when we talk about business needs, a lot of what you do is help people clarify what their business needs are based on their cloud usage. And based on that, I really look to you as an expert now on how this industry has expanded. And I call you that expert, and you can deny it or accept it anymore. Whatever it is, you're the person right now who I think has the loudest voice when it comes to what's been going on in big trends financially for people in this particular world. So what I want to start by asking you is, you know, where do you kind of see yourself helping people best in their transitionary period, when they're going maybe from, let's say, hybrid to fully cloud native, something like that? Where do you kind of walk in the door for people?
Generally, when there's an expensive problem and people are wondering either about the bill or what that bill is going to be, more aptly. And I'd argue that the most interesting value that I tend to deliver is reassuring people that what they're doing isn't bizarre. Mm-hmm. It isn't necessarily off in the weeds doing something strange and different that no one else could possibly understand. Mm-hmm. It's and reassuring that, yeah, no one has a clear grasp on this. So it's more or less external validation of the path that they're on, first and foremost.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond that, it comes down to, oh, yeah, the thing you're doing works super well in an on-prem environment. Here's the architectural nuance that means you're going to pay through the nose for it if you bring that to a cloud environment.
Mm-hmm.
And helping people, I guess, realize that what that path looks like is not necessarily clear from the beginning until you walk down it. I mean, one of our public companies that is migrating in that exact direction is Scribd. They are a public reference customer of ours, and they mm-hmm. are very aware of the fact that what worked in a data center style environment is not necessarily going to work in an AWS or other cloud provider environment as such. So understanding what those limitations are, what impact that has on the architecture, it's a lot of fun. But it all starts with the economic analysis, because that is what, I guess, the closest thing we have to measuring business value.
Sure.
You can do all kinds of things from a perspective of, oh, we saw this on the stage at a conference, so conferenceware is what we're going to build, but it doesn't actually solve a real problem, and it doesn't align with what's important to various companies.
And what I find to be really difficult for a lot of companies when they recognize they've implemented a certain portion of their technology into the cloud, and they realize, well, you know, this isn't working quite as well because we're not sure why. It's not as good as our implementation in the data center. It's simply because maybe your architectural design didn't really meet what the cloud is. And I think that what we're learning is that the cloud isn't just a replacement for your data center. It's a new way to do your IT. And that's going to require... Well, ideally,
in some cases, you take a look at people's cloud footprints, it looks an awful lot like a data center. And I'm as guilty of this as anyone. My first few cloud buildouts looked exactly like what you'd see in a data mm-hmm. center.
Yeah, same here with a VPC when I was early on and working in consulting. You know, to me, it made the most sense to just set up like this VPC with another VPC connected to it with a certain amount of redundancy and a ton of what it looked like two data centers across the globe. Across the country. And I just didn't really see what I was doing that was different than putting computers in the rack, other than I didn't have to physically do it anymore. And the bills were tremendous.
Oh, of course. It turns out the cloud doesn't run on other people's computers. It runs on money.
Yeah, absolutely. So that being said, 2019 was a big, big year for money in the industry of cloud. I think it was something like AWS hit $33 billion in running revenue. And I think Azure hit something like $20 billion in running revenue. This is pretty remarkable growth for all these companies. And I'm just curious, is in 2019, what was something that really excited you about what came out of the world of cloud?
I think a growing awareness that we saw echoed through all the providers, where suddenly building the fastest, most exciting, far-fetched, far-flung technologies were not necessarily going to be the things that won hearts and minds. It seemed that all of the large providers this year in their various conferences spoke directly to Big E Enterprise and migrating from data center environments into a cloud environment. And for some folks, AWS, that seemed to be something that they hadn't really addressed directly before, other than in small ways of, here's how you migrate those things in, as mm-hmm. opposed to embracing them where they are. And we see this across the board. GCP had Anthos in that approach. Surprisingly, the company you see this the least from is Azure, just because historically they have such a broad base of already installed Microsoft customers in data centers that mm-hmm. they were the best position to be there already. So they had an interesting head start here. We'll see how that plays out in the coming few years.
Yeah, I mean, we all can kind of say, and I say this, you know, I will go ahead and disclose, you know, I'm an Azure employee, but I know that Azure has played some catch up in the world of cloud behind AWS, mainly based on technology or usability. But the one thing that I know that Microsoft has had at their benefit is understanding of enterprise sales and marketing. And I think that that's probably where they make up for a lack of tooling that you may be hearing about lately.
Oh, absolutely. I've said for a while now that one of Microsoft's big advantages in the world of cloud is they have 40 years of experience apologizing for software failures. And people think I'm being insulting when I say that, but I'm really not. This is what clouds do. It's what computers do. They break. And being able to apologize for that and explain that to business instead of purely technical stakeholders is a critical skill in the time of cloud. That Absolutely. Is something that Microsoft excels at, and Google and Amazon have had to learn.
And, you know, let's talk a little bit more about 2019. You and I both went to the DevOps Enterprise Summit this past year.
We did.
And Gene Kim had a really great conversation about if you're being honest with your customers, you're delivering information, you're making sure that there's continuity in services, that these are ultimately the things that the enterprise wants. And while we spend a lot of time on community, it's been interesting to see how the enterprise has really come to the cloud and said, we're here. Let give us something. And that's the way it's come out to me a bit.
It feels to me like there was this big meeting to which none of the rest of us were invited to, where all these companies got together, looked at each other across the table, dropped all pretense and said, you know what? We really suck at running data centers. And it's kind of fun watching them now suddenly embrace cloud and industries and verticals where they never had the ability to do that before for whatever reason.
Mm-hmm. And the one thing that I've noticed, and this was another trend from 2019 I noticed, was how the cloud as a burstable environment for your already existing data center became something that you started hearing more enterprises talking about, where companies like, I think it's like CompuWare, have started building out better ways for mainframes to have access to cloud technologies. It seems like it's a new world for these people.
Oh, yes. And I'm sure the AWS 400 is imminent. Remember, Amazon's entire product strategy is yes. They lie awake at night worried that someone who isn't them could be making money doing a thing somewhere and then figure out how best to position themselves in that market.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's true. And what I've seen in the last year also is that a lot of these big cloud providers, all three, had really bought into their Kubernetes services. That managed Kubernetes is one of the biggest things that I think have been driving across the industry. I can say, as somebody who has some, you know, behind the scenes, at least on the Azure side, it's one of the fastest growing products that has happened in Azure's history, if not the fastest product in Azure history.
Oh, I don't doubt it. It's a hot buzzword right now. Personally, I can't stand it for a variety of reasons, but I accept that it's a real thing. Most of my objection to it professionally these days comes from the fact that if you run everything on top of Kubernetes, you have abstracted away what you're doing sufficiently from the cloud provider's built-in primitives that it becomes very challenging just to wind up doing workload attribution of cost. If you have a Kubernetes cluster and you have 10 different workloads running on top of it, which one's the expensive one is surprisingly difficult to figure out programmatically. You have to start doing more of a qualitative analysis.
Do you believe it's based on just poor orchestration of like what size nodes you need and what size of containers, and it all just comes back to that over-provisioning thing?
Not necessarily. It has a lot, partially that. There's definitely aspects of that, but all right, you have 10 different workloads running on a particular node, for example, because everything's spread across all your nodes. Now you're seeing significant cross-AZ data transfer charges. What workload's driving that primarily? That's the sort of thing where it gets very challenging to figure out using the native tooling you normally could with just instances or a managed container service that integrates more directly with what the provider gives you. But when you're running that on top of Kubernetes, you get to turn this into a murder mystery that you get to solve yourself, where the tooling is still limited and still early days.
Mm-hmm. And maybe this is why we saw, and to bring up another look at it, 2019, HashiCorp rise up so well in the industry and providing tooling around, I guess, Gnosticism that will also utilize a lot of the value that the clouds provide you individually.
Oh, one of the best conversations I had over on my podcast, Screaming in the Cloud, this past year was with Mitchell Hashimoto. And he and I sort of see multi-cloud in the same light, in that it is not something that's terrific on an individualized workload basis. His argument, but I tend to agree with, is that Terraform provides workflow portability and not workload portability. Okay. One of those is worth pursuing and one of them is not. And I agree with pretty much everything he said from that perspective. I think that multi-cloud is something that people are still beating the war drums about. It's probably time for me to revisit my stance on that particular chestnut. But by and large, it's still something that we're seeing a lot of noise around.
Yeah, it's something that companies in the cloud space constantly are reminding you that it's available to you. But they don't want you to actually do it. And until just recently, if I'm right, like this was the first year Amazon talked about multi-cloud, really, in one of their reInvents. Am I right?
They talked a lot about hybrid. They're still avoiding multi-cloud. My cynical perspective on multi-cloud is that every cloud provider hates the idea of multi-cloud until they realize that someone, be it a large customer or a government or something, is going to go with a different cloud provider, and then suddenly multi-cloud is the right move. So it's not hugely surprising to me that AWS was very anti-multi-cloud while they were the clear front runner in almost everything. Mm-hmm. Now that we're starting to see that it's much more than a one-horse race, they're starting to first, I think from a cynical perspective, appreciate that. Secondly, when you talk to large enterprises and you start seeing what's going on, all the big companies use a little bit of everything.
Sure.
So as much as you may say, pick one provider and go all in, as I do, you'll see that different divisions have picked different providers. There's a particular service offered by one that makes a given workload a lot more sensible on that particular provider. And I'm not necessarily opposed to that approach. What drives me nuts is the idea if we're going to build an entire system greenfield and we're going to make it so that we can deploy it on top of any given provider. Mm-hmm. Great. Now you have to build your own NoSQL solution. You have to wind up building your own load balancer interaction because none of those two work the same way across any provider.
Yeah.
And the various gotchas and corner and edge cases wind up slowing down your feature velocity to such an extreme degree that you almost have gained nothing from going to cloud other than more reliable disk failures.
Sure. So maybe, that's funny the way you've kind of described it, because I went to an event and I saw, I believe it was the CISO of HBO at the time, and he was talking about their multi-cloud approach. And they say it's more about, for them, was about availability in regional areas. Like they said, well, we needed CDN endpoints in places that one provider couldn't provide over the other. So they needed to create a way to have it as agnostic as possible, but still capable of working across multiple providers. It was an interesting kind of look into a real use case for multi-cloud.
Is probably a fair assessment. Use cases of multi-cloud are increasingly areas where you're starting to see some people trying to innovate their way into proving the model out. Mm-hmm. I'm not seeing nearly as much from individual companies that are chasing this down. Even taking an HBO perspective, there is the question of, all right, are you going to pick a cloud provider? Great. And go all in? Fine. Who's it going to be? AWS. Great. Except, they also are trying to do their whole Amazon Prime Video Now instant, whatever they're calling it this year. And okay, so they are a competitor. We should at least have an exodus strategy there. And that tends to lead people down the path of at least identifying how they'll leave if the market turns it away they don't accept. I mean, Amazon's product strategy remains yes. So they're going to continue to be a competitive threat to basically everyone.
Yeah. I wanted to talk about another kind of new thing where it's something that I believe it's part of the cloud catching up that I noticed this year. And I just wanted to see what you thought about it in context of cloud finances being part of the decision. So Spot VMs has been something that you've had in AWS for years. It's been a big part of pricing. And now Azure went ahead and announced spot pricing for VMs. Do you think it's too late, or does this make sense for them to finally kind of provide this? And how much do people end up saving?
I think it'll make an awful lot of sense. If your workload supports it, you're silly not to look into it. Mm-hmm. The challenge that I think that Azure may see in a way that AWS did not, is if you take a look at their broad-based constituencies, for those who aren't familiar, the idea behind this is you can get a virtual machine or an instance for anywhere between 70 to 90% off of what you'd pay for that on demand, with the caveat that it could be yanked away from you at any time when there's a capacity shortfall. And if your workload supports it, it's terrific. The challenge is that AWS started off basically uncontested for almost 6 years in the world of cloud. And their stuff, when it first launched, was pretty crappy from a reliability point of view. So a lot of things that were early movers to the cloud were definitionally stuff that could handle interruption of individual nodes or groups of nodes. Azure's on the other side of that divide. They're still the only large cloud provider that offers an SLA around individualized instance types, around individual instances, where you have a VM that's running, and there's a guarantee that that VM will continue to run, or you get some service credit applied to it. It's a statement of belief in the reliability and persistency of single nodes. If you have a workload that can sustain that sort of interruption, that's not a big deal to you. But for an awful lot of Azure customers, that is a major deal. In fact, that is one of the deciding factors of why they pick Azure, according to some reports. So I would argue that if, depending on what Azure's customer base looks like, Spot VMs may not be a viable path forward for the vast majority of their workloads. And to be clear, for an awful lot of AWS customers, Spot's not viable for them either.
Okay, that's a good look into it. So the other thing that I noticed, 2019 was another big year of making databases cheaper. It's what I've seen across everybody. Everybody wants to make databases cheaper, so use more of it, it appears. Are databases really taking that move out of the old data centers? Are they really moving into the cloud, or is this a lot of just small movement for companies?
People want to see their data live close to the rest of their environment. I don't see a future where people are going to have their databases live in data centers, but everything else live in the cloud. Where I think you're going to see that gravitic effect, where there's that attraction that draws database workloads with it. From a cynical perspective, again, I think you'll find that regardless of what the technology under your database is, or whatever provider you wind up picking, it's sticky. If you pick something that winds up being opening up a lock-in, either architecturally or in some other kind of proprietary lock-in way, it's one of the hardest things possible to move off of.
Gotcha.
And I suspect that what we're seeing is that people are discounting the various database aspects. If you're seeing significant discounting on that, I have to confess I'm not seeing huge cost declines in my side of the world on that. But by driving database adoption, you're making it harder for people to switch architecturally. It can be done, but it's a lot more painful to move a database than it is to move a web server.
Absolutely. It seems to be one of the big reasons why people will actually choose one provider of another by how much they'll simplify their database process moving forward.
This is why I use Route 53, Amazon's DNS server, as my preferred database.
I've heard you had this. I think you actually once asked me about this on Screaming Into the Cloud, if I thought this was a good idea when I was working for Mongo, to which I think I said no.
Oh, DNS is a fantastic thing you can misuse into being a database, regardless of how terrible your approach might be. Because everyone, well, they think they understand DNS. So by the time that it turns out that they don't understand DNS, and no one fully understands DNS, then it's far too late, which is just wonderful for everyone.
Now, here's a subject that nobody understands. And it was a big hot button 2019 topic. And it's something that I think every person that probably you and I come in contact with on Twitter has had some sort of opinion on.
Please don't say politics.
No, deploy on Fridays.
Oh, geez, those things. Yes. I think that it is a interesting approach to wind up being opposed to it. I think that fundamentally, I don't have a whole lot of a unique perspective on it because for once, I don't have a strong opinion on it one way or the other. Remember, I built an entire business on top of being a strictly business hours problem.
Sure.
I have no software that's critical path for anyone. I don't really care if something winds up being, if I send a report to a customer on a Friday or I do an analysis on a Friday, it doesn't matter because I'm not rolling out software changes. I'm not building anything that has significant downside impact. I mean, worst case, my newsletter or my podcast, if I wind up changing the workflow for that and they get delayed a day, I'm not convinced most people would even notice, let alone have a problem with it.
So yeah, but it also puts into perspective, though, the different levels of SLA we put on importance, you know, on different parts of where we fall into the world of technology. I guess I ask just because it's been something I've been thinking about. And because it's turned out so much consternation between people, because some people say, well, Friday should be about ensuring that you're giving some safety to the people who work on call and you shouldn't throw in changes into the mix. Whereas other people will say your testing and all your processes should be strong enough to handle a deploy at any time. And right, these are all. Remember,
we're also talking about this as if everyone's workload is identical. We talk about this too in the sense of, oh, agile is the way in the future. Waterfall's dead. Yeah, tell that to people building spacecraft. You don't really get to send something into space, watch it explode, make a small change, send it to space again, watch it explode a little bit later in the process, and iterate your way to success. You've got to at some point understand that workflows and needs are going to vary from case to case. Sure, is don't deploy on Friday good for a lot of SaaS companies? Maybe, maybe not, but I think it's a more interesting debate there than it is on anything that tends to have a bit more of a reduced cycle time.
Mm-hmm. So I wanna make sure that I wrap up this time and use it very, very well. Because I really do appreciate you sharing with me, Corey.
Of course.
I want to ask you just a few more of your predictions for 2020. First, what do you think JEDI, any of the legal stuff becomes of it in regards to Amazon's challenge?
That's a really good question. I think they have a heavy road to hoe, because overturning any sort of government contract sets precedent that everyone wants to generally avoid. That said, coming from their position where it's a single bid contract going to Azure, contesting it, it's pure upside from AWS's perspective. Mm-hmm. There's also the realistic chance that if we're looking at administration change in one way or another, that we're going to see that maybe different things come to light. I don't really have a strong opinion on that. I mean, you take a look at it, it's $10 billion over 10 years. Well, good for it. They're seeing over $30 billion per year in existing business now, let alone in 10 years. So it's what? It averages or amortizes out to $1 out of every 30 winds up becoming part of this project. It's big, but it's not changed the business big. Frankly,
yeah.
I think it's just going to be a whole lot of arguing and whining and complaining over stuff that, by and large, doesn't really move the needle on anyone's particular business.
It's probably a good way to think about it. That's interesting. So products, what products do you think are really bound for, and let's not just say the three big companies, but say of the ones that are out there in the market, the third-party products. What's one that you think is really going to outshine them all in 2020?
Hard to say. I mean, you can take a look at certain areas of improvement and disruption across the space. Anything that helps providers talk to one another or requires integration from multiple providers at the same time is a seam, and that tends to wind up being a decent spot for innovation. Whenever you're doing something around one provider that they're terrible at, you're really only a feature away from having no business left. And that's going to continue to be a concern. I'm also a fan of the monitoring tools, because are you going to trust your cloud provider, who, for example, may not update its status page in less than 2 hours, to tell you when that provider is having problems? Likely not. That's a great opportunity for a third-party story. But increasingly, we're seeing a lot of the third-party stories out there just not resonating in any meaningful way. If you wind up walking down one of these expo halls and going on a nature walk and talking to different vendors, you start to see that they're telling more or less different versions of the same exact story. And it just feels like you're waiting for a die-off when one of the fundamental tenets that all these companies are basing their product on shifts. We'll see.
That's really interesting. Hey, so how can people learn more about what you're doing at Duckbill, what you're doing in general? How do people learn about what Corey's up to day to day?
I wonder that myself some days, because people seem to know more about my schedule than I do. Maybe I left a calendar open somewhere. But they can find me on Twitter at QuinnyPig, that's Q-U-I-N-N-Y, PIG. They can go to lastweekinaws.com and follow the blog, the newsletter, and both podcasts. And of course, they can stop me on the street and say, hey, are you? And then Andrew asked if I'm Ben Thompson. You talk about a newsletter and wearing his sweatshirt. Yes. Yes, I am Ben Thompson.
That's great. Man, you know, I just really appreciate this time. We see each other here and there over the whole 12 months of a year. And I really do get to appreciate, you know, chatting with you. And I think we always find out something new or interesting talking to one another. So always appreciate it, man.
Excellent. As always, a pleasure to talk with you, Jay. Thanks for having me.
No problem. So have a great holiday, and I'll talk to you again soon. So we'll wrap up this week's episode of On Call Nightmares in just a moment.
Well, that was another great conversation, this time with Corey Quinn of the Duckbill Group. He's a cloud of economists there. He's a really funny guy, and I think you'll love following him on Twitter. Give that a shot, at QuinnyPig. And I really just want to say thanks again for making this a really cool first year doing the podcast. I couldn't have done it without you listening and being part of it. So I will see you in the new year with more interviews, more discussions, and more looks at the world of being on call and technology, cloud, you name it. So thank you all. You can reach out at OnCallNightmare on Twitter or OnCallNightmares@gmail.com. Talk to you next year.